Let's take out our Bibles and turn together to the book of Exodus. It is the second book in the Bible. And this morning, in a few moments, we're going to read from Exodus chapter 12. We are still in the book of Exodus. We began in September looking at this book. So we kind of began the beginning of the book, and now we're slowly making our way through it. We're going to take a break starting next week, Sunday, for Advent, Christmas, and then after, into the new year, we enter the book of Exodus again, and I really have no idea how long we'll be in Exodus, because there's just a lot in Exodus that we could talk about. So eventually, someone might have to say, that's enough. Enough of Exodus, let's move on to something else. But for the time being, we're going to be in this for a little while yet. There are some sermon notes on the church's website, nacchurch.org, if you want to follow along under recent news. And this morning, we're looking at the story of the Passover. I'm assuming some of us at least know about the story of the Passover. We're going to read part of that this morning. And I probably can't emphasize enough how important the Passover is in the book of Exodus for the Jewish people, for the Old Testament, and the story of the Bible. Like, it is this monumental event. And also for our understanding of who Jesus is. So as we'll hear in a few moments, God actually kind of restarts time with the Passover event. He says to the people, this will now be the first month for you. Right? So the Passover is now, we're kind of restarting the people of Israel. We're at least going to restart your calendar. This is now going to be the first month. Some scholars say it's like a whole new creation is starting with the Passover. And as we jump very quickly, kind of quickly through the story of the Bible, we realize the Passover is not just a past event, but Jesus, when he's ministering on the earth, he comes to that moment just before he's crucified, the evening before he's crucified, he's having the Passover meal with his disciples. Now, Jesus had the Passover at least 30 times in his lifetime on earth. I'm thinking these days most of those Passovers may be in the city of Jerusalem, because the Jewish people would, that was one celebration they would all want to go to Jerusalem for. So he's here in Jerusalem again having the Passover, and he says during the Passover, this is my body. So this meal is not just about the past, it's about the present, it's about me. This is my blood. So Jesus is saying something extraordinary about the meal. Other New Testament writers will say of Jesus, he is the Lamb. And one author in 2 Corinthians 5 says, he is our Passover Lamb. He has been crucified for us. So lots of connections back to this moment, this Passover moment. And we also read in the end of the Bible, we have this scene in the book of Revelation, that scary book, but not really all that scary. Revelation chapter 5, this scene of worship. The Bible talks about the throne in heaven, four living creatures around the throne, 24 elders around the throne, and they're singing a song to the Lamb. And they're saying, you are worthy to take the scroll and open its seals, the scroll from God with all that's going to happen. You're the only one worthy to open the scroll because you were slain just like the Passover lamb, and with your blood you purchase for God persons from every tribe, language, people, and nations. A vision of the future, what's going to happen in the church. Now, I'm just saying this really quickly this morning. We could spend more time on the connections between Jesus and this Passover, but this morning I want to ask the question, why did these people have to put blood on their door frames? Why put blood on the door frames of their houses? So I'm going to invite Elsie to come up and read some verses from Exodus chapter 12.
The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, this month is to be for you the first month of your year. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbor, having taken into account the number of people there are. You are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect, and you may take them from the sheep or the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the members of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. That same night, they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire, along with bitter herbs, the bread made without yeast. Do not eat the meat raw or boiled in water, but roasted over a fire with the head, legs, and internal organs. Do not leave any of it till morning. If some is left till morning, you must burn it. This is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals. And I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. Then Moses summoned all the elders of Israel and said to them, "Go at once and select the animals for your families and slaughter the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop, dip it into the blood in the basin, and put some of the blood on the top and on the sides, on both sides of the door frame. None of you shall go out of the door of your house until morning. When the Lord goes through the land to strike down the Egyptians, he will see the blood on the top and sides of the door frame and will pass over that doorway, and he will not permit the destroyer to enter your houses and strike you down." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. So again, I'm trying to ask the question this morning, why do these people put blood on their door frames? Why did they do this? And we might say, obviously, because God told them to, or invited them to, or this was the instruction from God, and that's true. Or we might say, well, they didn't want their firstborn to be killed like the firstborn in Egypt, so they're trying to save their firstborn and save their families from the destroyer who's coming, and that's true. And maybe they didn't realize, but certainly the blood of the lamb and any kind of talk of sacrifice in the Bible always points to the idea that you really can't save yourself. Right? They could have stood there with swords or shields when the angel was coming, but that would not have stopped the angel. Right, sacrifice always points to the fact that something or someone outside of you must save you. So maybe there are some self-help books that might help us, but we cannot write any self-salvation books, right? Sometimes we can help each other with some wisdom, blah, 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 but the Bible's quite clear. We cannot save ourselves ultimately. And that's what this event is also telling us. And these are all good answers. Maybe there's some answers more that you have. But I want to ask the question again. I want to put some emphasis where I didn't put it at first to tell you the kind of question I'm trying to ask, because I'm asking this question: why did these people put blood on their door frames? Why did these slaves put blood on their door frames? Hopefully, Maybe some of you are saying, okay, now I understand where you're going with this, right? I've never asked this question before of the Bible. And I have to confess, and maybe some of you are kind of picking up on this, he starts asking a lot of questions about the Bible recently. I'm sort of wondering, does he still believe? Because he's asking these questions he's never asked before, and maybe some of us have never asked before. I don't know. But it struck me, why is God asking the people of Israel to put blood on their door frames? Now, I have to recognize sometimes it's something in me, something that's maybe I'm wrestling with that leads to these questions I'm asking and also this morning. And sometimes it's thinking about maybe some of us who come on Sunday morning, because I recognize not everyone maybe knows the story really well. And one of the best things for me is to engage with people who have never read the Bible before and they hear this story or any story in the Bible, and I need to hear that immediate response. So maybe someone might say, what's going on here? Why do these people have to put blood on their door frames? Because isn't Pharaoh the bad guy? Isn't Pharaoh the bully, the abuser, the slave master? Have you ever asked that? I've never asked that till this past week. Why is this plague that's supposed to be on Pharaoh, why is God telling his people, oh, you got a blood on your door frames because the plague is coming? Right? He's not bringing the plague on them, is he? Isn't this 10th wonder, this 10th plague supposed to be for Pharaoh and his people because he is the one, they are the ones who are enslaving these people of Israel? So if there was no blood on the door frames, would the destroyer come into the homes of the people of Israel? And the answer seems to be yes. God would allow his angel to come also into their homes, and it doesn't seem fair to me. Like, why would God do that? It's sort of like, and this is not a great example, I realize that, but it's sort of like when you're younger, your brother or sister stole the cookies from the cookie jar. And everyone knows it's not me, it's him or her, but your mom or dad says, judgment's coming on all of you, right? You all got to go to your room, or you all got to do this to avoid the judgments. And you're saying, what's going on here? And anyone tracking with this question this morning? Because for me, it's kind of like it's a live question in my mind. What's going on here? Now, some of you might say, well, Pastor, you got to read the story, because all the wonders come on all the people. Like, God just brings his wonders, his plagues on the Egyptians and the people of Israel. So this is just a continuation of all these plagues. Except the problem is, if you read the story, that's not what happens. Right, the plagues come on everyone, first plague, second plague, third plague. But then starting with plague number 4, God makes a distinction between the Egyptians and the Israelites. So plague 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, the people of Israel are not being impacted by these plagues. But then the final plague, he's telling the people, oh, you can put blood on your door frames because the angel of death is coming. I'm again asking, why is that? Now again, hopefully, okay, now we understand what this guy is trying to say this morning, the questions he's asking. Maybe you've asked it, maybe you haven't. But as I was thinking about it, the answer that came to my mind, the reason why this happens, is the most uncomfortable truth the Bible has to tell us. At least for us living in the 21st century. I'm not sure if 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, they would have felt uncomfortable with this, but we do today, right? And the uncomfortable truth is that there is something wrong in every human heart. Every human heart is moving away from God. Every human heart is rebelling against God. Every human heart is a little bit like Pharaoh's heart. And the basic truth is that although Pharaoh is the one who has committed the sin of enslaving people, abusing his authority, he is not the only one who has done something wrong. I'm not trying to say the people are enslaved because they did something wrong, right? I'm not saying that. They're not being enslaved as a judgment. I'm not saying in their slavery they did something wrong. But even outside of what Pharaoh has done, there are things going on in their lives, like they go on in our lives, that are wrong. And in this event, God is saying that needs the covering of the blood. We read this in many places in the Bible, but one of them is just kind of just a plain, simple verse, which I sometimes really need in my life. Romans 3:23. Supposedly Romans 3:23, if I forgot that verse, here it is. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Pretty simple verse, but important verse for us, right? All humanity, all people are wrongdoers, sinners, all of our hearts go the wrong way. So when we look even at us this morning, as difficult as it is to believe, when you just look at humanity together, without God's intervention, without God's grace and mercy, without God working in our lives, there really is not bad guys and good guys. There really isn't the healthy and the sick. There really isn't the righteous and the unrighteous. All of us have gone wrong. All of us have done wrong. All of us are sinned and flawed and rebels and broken. And we've been singing at least a couple times recently this song by Andrew Peterson called "Is He Worthy?" And in the song, one of the lines is, "Do you feel the world is broken?" And the answer is supposed to be, we sing, "We do." And we could change that question just by saying, "Do you feel you're broken?" And the response is supposed to be, "Oh, I do, we do." Because this is the experience of the human heart, the human life. It's kind of the bad news message of the Bible that we need to hear if we're ever going to hear the good news of the Bible. So sin not limited to this particular individual, or sin not limited to these particular people over here, or sin not limited to people who, let's say, are in prison and we all know they've done bad things, and sin not limited to certain people with a certain kind of background, but all have gone astray. All of our hearts are going astray. Which is a point I want to make this morning. You know, whenever we talk about sin, at least my memory is, if you had asked me, maybe if you still ask me today, my initial reaction, if you say, "What is this sin the Bible talks about?" My immediate response is breaking God's law, right? Doing what God told me not to do. Or not doing what God told me to do. It's a violation of what God has said, which is true. It's true. But I realize now that if that's my default definition of what sin is, I'm in trouble. Because sin is simply behavior, right? So don't take those cookies. Bad. And if I can stop that, well, maybe I can stop the sin. But that's not sin. Deep down, right? Behavior is just the expression of the sin. The sin is really working on the inside. Hearts that are disoriented or misdirected, or I might use the really theological word, hearts that are wonky. Hearts that are, whoa, you know, I love God. I don't really love God. I'm following God. No, I'm not really following, you know, just not really sure. Hearts that are shaky. Hearts that are not always, you're not really sure which way that heart's going to go. Hearts that hold on to all kinds of things as if they were our God, but it's not God himself. Hearts that if you look inside, you realize, oh, it's not God at the center. It's really the self at the center. The self trying to direct our lives. And I hear this in the way I talk sometimes, or maybe the way we talk sometimes, when I hear about it's my choice. It's my life. It's my decisions, my destiny, my money, my rights. Sometimes you just stop and think, hey, what's the message there? Right? The message, of course, is me. It's all about me. So when we talk about, and that's what this morning I'm trying to say, Pharaoh in the book of Exodus is a huge sinner. Like, there are hardly enough words to describe how bad Pharaoh is. He is the evil one in the book of Exodus, no doubt about it. But when we talk as sinners about the sin of another, we should be aware also of our own sin. So what sometimes happens, and maybe not with you, but I sometimes sense it in my heart, and when I hear certain people talk, I think, man, we focus. You know, we could do this in Exodus. Pharaoh, bad guy, bad things, doing bad things, and we focus on him, and we condemn him and his sin, and anyone like that. And when we do that, we do what sometimes the church is so liable of doing, so easy to do. Those people are so bad. Or we focus on the sins of others, and somehow when we do that, we feel better about our own sins, our own lives. Or we kind of forget, oh yeah, I did that once before, or something like that. Or, I'm not that bad. I feel smug or self-satisfied. I maximize someone else's sin so that somebody might maybe minimize my sin. I shine the spotlight on them so the spotlight won't shine on me. And this happens in the church so often. But I also hear it in our society. Now, this morning, when people do bad things, I don't want to minimize that. I don't want to say, no, 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 it was okay. They can say whatever they want. They can do what, that's not my approach this morning. But what I've heard recently, at least what I think I've heard, is we're talking about a certain person. A certain person everyone knows about. A certain person who said something wrong that everyone knows about. That was wrong to say. But it feels like as a society, we gang up on someone, and it feels like I never hear anyone say, I once said something like that. I once had a thought like that. Or maybe they said what they said because of what other people influenced them, or maybe I was encouraging that in some way. I hear a lot of, oh, they shouldn't have said that. That bad person, let's put them in the corner, you know, whatever. Put them in the room, close the door. But even in our society, I'm longing to hear a humility about the state of our own hearts. So again, I'm not saying there is no wrong. There is lots of wrong that happens in our society. I'm not saying we should ignore that or minimize that at all. I'm just saying that sin does not only reside in Pharaoh or in Hitler or in Don or Donald or anyone else we can think about this morning. And there are moments in the Bible when we get a glimpse of this. We get a glimpse of the author talking about, say, the sin of others, but then acknowledging his or her own sin. So we have this great psalm in the Bible, Psalm 139. It's this wonderful psalm that oftentimes I share verses from the psalm with parents who just had children because it talks about how we're fearfully and wonderfully made. And I love that psalm. But then toward the end, if you ever read that psalm, they get these verses at the end, almost at the end of Psalm 139, where the author starts talking about the wicked and the bloodthirsty. And they're like, whoa, what just happened? We're talking about babies in the womb and God knitting us together. And then he's talking about the evil people. And I can't always connect with that. But I think there are moments in our lives where people can connect with that. I'm thinking this morning about this woman who was attacked recently. She was on vacation, first night of vacation. Someone came into her room, attacked her. She needed 9 hours of facial reconstruction surgery. I'm thinking a person like that is saying, I can't stand my attacker. I hate my attacker. What they did to me. So this writer is probably struggling with someone who has done something to them. But then right at the end of Psalm 139, after talking about the wicked and the bloodthirsty and the evil person, the writer says, search me, O God. Sort of some honest reflection. Know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there's any offensive or, other translations, wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. When I read that, I think that's someone who's aware, not just the other person, but also me. There could be, or there probably is some wickedness in my heart, O Lord. Shine the spotlight there as well. Or Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 7, he's telling us, don't be judgmental. Don't be judgmental, which people confuse with making judgments. Right, so people read Jesus and they say, we shouldn't make any judgments about anybody, which is impossible to do. We're always making judgments about others. But Jesus is saying, don't be judgmental. And judgmental is, you've done something wrong. I'm going to tell you about it, but I have never done anything wrong. I'm going to judge you, but we're not talking about my life. I'm closing my eyes to what I've done. And this can happen quite easily, especially among religious people, right? So Jesus says, and this is, you got to read this verse really carefully, right? Romans 7:5, you hypocrites. Now, don't do that. What you have to do, first take the plank out of your own eye, so see what's wrong in your life, right? Without doing that, our vision of others gets really weird, really, really wrong. Take the plank out of your eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. So when I recognize the plank in my eye, or the maybe the struggles or the sin or the wrongdoing in my life, when I talk to someone else, the conversation is quite different, right? I come not judgmental. I come aware of what's also happening in my heart. Now, this morning, please don't hear me wrong. I'm not saying let's not talk about sin. Let's minimize sin. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying when we talk about the sin of others, let's remind ourselves the blood is also needed for our sin. So there should be times in our lives where we hear the Bible speaking and we say, that's me. I need to hear that. Like the person, the man who Jesus was talking to, this man, come and heal my daughter. Come and heal my daughter. And then in a confession, he says, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. Whoa. This man recognizes there's these two things going on in my life, belief and unbelief. And I think when we recognize that, maybe we can be more compassionate to those who say, I don't quite get that. I don't understand God in that way. I got all kinds of questions and maybe even doubts about all of this. Or people who recognize, I might give all the show of righteousness, but there's all kinds of unrighteousness happening in my life. And that helps me when I can recognize that for people who I sense are maybe doing unrighteous things. Or when people, you know, we hear about, their love for money makes them do awful things. You know, we've heard stories of, I love money so much, I'm going to kill my parents to get the inheritance. And we might say, I don't think I'd ever do that. But I can understand the grip that money has on my heart. Or we hear about someone who gets so angry, they do something awful. And we say, oh, Lord, I never want to do that, but I can understand. I've been angry myself. What I'm asking for this morning, through the story of the Passover, is some understanding that the angel of death has passed over, not because I'm so good, not because the people of Israel were righteous and great and good, but because there was the blood. Because it was the blood of the Lamb on the door frames that the angel of death passed over. Recently, I had someone tell me, and I was kind of surprised that they said this, but they said, I'm so thankful on Sunday mornings when we have the call to confession. My thoughts are not put on the screen. Like you know, the thoughts I've had this past week are not put on the screen for everyone to see. And I said, I don't think anybody would want to have that. Imagine your thoughts on the screen on Sunday morning. Let's confess the sins of this person and hear, you know, whatever. James's thoughts on the screen or Sam's thoughts on the screen. When I heard this person say that, I thought they understand what's going on inside of them. They understand, I might look all put together, but things going on in my heart, in my mind, in my soul are not always as they should be. And this morning, I'm asking us as a church that we watch our posture with each other. We watch our posture also with the world. The world has heard enough condemnation from the church. The world has heard enough self-righteousness from the church. The world has heard enough about we are better than you, or we would never do that from the church community. What the world needs is, I believe, some honest assessment about the state of our own hearts in appropriate ways, pointing them as we point ourselves to the Lamb, Jesus Christ, and then reminding them and ourselves the Lamb, Jesus, is always welcoming sinners. He's always welcoming the sick and the broken and the struggling. This is the posture of Jesus all the time. Come to me, come to me. All you who are weary and broken and your hearts are wonky, come to me.